You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, hunting and archery have a long history in Wisconsin, and some archers embrace the ways of the past. We'll hear how they're crafting their own bows from single pieces of wood.
First, President Trump reportedly told Republican senators yesterday that the House-passed health care bill is mean. He urged them to create a version of the bill that is, quote, more generous, according to congressional sources.
Senate Republicans are working to finish their draft of the bill, but they're not planning to release it publicly before its vote. Right now, the deadline for the bill is to be done before the July 4th recess.
Yasmeen Abutaleb joins us now. She's a health care correspondent for Reuters. Yasmeen, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start with that House health care bill, which, when it passed, was met with a celebration in the White House Rose Garden. Reportedly, yesterday, the president called that bill mean. Do you have a sense of what he was referring to?
I think he was referring to the projected coverage losses in the House bill and was saying that it doesn't cover enough people, and he hopes the Senate bill will be more generous and cover more people, which is obviously what the Senate has been aiming for.
Do those remarks, or at least that particular remark, we don't know exactly what was said, but does it come as a surprise in terms of the president's attitude as it stands currently toward that House health care bill?
Yeah, it was definitely a surprise because, as I'm sure anyone who's been following the healthcare debate knows, Trump celebrated the passage of the House healthcare bill with a big Rose Garden press conference and was pretty chummy with a bunch of the members and congratulating Paul Ryan and saying people thought he didn't have it, but clearly he has it, and called it an incredible piece of legislation or something along those lines. And so for him to backtrack on that and say it's mean shows a bit of his susceptibility to the media coverage of the bill, but also is tough for the House Republican members who voted for a deeply unpopular bill.
What would it mean for them personally? Could it inflict actual political damage, or is this a volley that seems to reflect more about the mood of the day?
It's hard to tell. Things change pretty quickly in Washington, as I'm sure anyone knows. I think what it does do is it makes it harder for members to trust if they take a vote because the president asks them to, that he'll back them up later. Because he was obviously twisting arms with the House version of the bill, he really wanted to get this passed and get a win. And it's pretty unusual to celebrate only half of a passage of a bill. The bill hasn't actually made its way to his desk yet. So I think it'll raise questions about whether members are willing to take a tough vote for him in the future.
And moving on to the Senate health care bill, their version of the bill being drafted. Right now, it is being drafted behind closed doors. So far, what do we know about that bill?
Well, we know that there are a lot of big issues they still haven't resolved. So we know that they haven't decided what they're going to do about Medicaid. There are some pretty deep divides in the party about how to handle that. There seems to be agreement over having a stability fund for reinsurance programs and high-risk pools and that sort of thing. But other than that, we don't know a ton. We know that they're thinking about keeping some of the taxes in Obamacare to pay for their bill, but there seem to be some pretty deep divides in the Senate over what to do about some pretty contentious issues like Medicaid, like the tax credits. And we also know that they don't plan to touch the pre-existing conditions protections, especially after they saw how unpopular it was in the House version.
Yasmeen Abutaleb is with us now. She's a health care correspondent for Reuters, talking about the Republican health care bill and where it stands right now. And one question, especially raised by Democrats, is why is the bill being drafted behind closed doors, and why hasn't that draft been released to the public?
So the senators say that they haven't completed a draft. They still haven't worked out some big issues, and so they're still in discussions and don't want to release something preliminary that it could change, and they want to give people the ability to talk out differences and work it out. So from what we understand and from what we've heard from sources in the Senate, they don't actually have a full draft yet. But they've obviously come under fire for drafting this in secret and not giving Democrats and other senators the ability to weigh in and offer amendments and that sort of thing. Senators say, you know, those accusations are overblown and that anyone is welcome to come to their meetings, but Democrats have no interest in engaging.
Now, you mentioned before that the president is looking for, from Senate Republicans, a more generous version of the bill. Do we have more specifics on what exactly that would mean?
We haven't heard that the president offered specific policy proposals, but that's obviously a big concern for the Senate, is they don't want those massive coverage losses. So there are a group of moderate Republicans who are proposing, you know, that the House bill would cut off the Medicaid expansion in 2020 pretty abruptly. The Senate, some of these moderate senators want to offer a seven-year glide path, meaning states would have 7 years from 2020 to 2027 to find a way to cover more people with less money. And so the expansion would be phased out over 7 years. And the thinking is that gives some governors more time to figure out what to do about it. It's also expedient politically because they won't have to run when Medicaid cuts are implemented. But they still, and they want to undertake a pretty fundamental change to Medicaid and restructure how the federal funding, and that'll obviously result in less, but they haven't decided how to do that yet.
Now, when President Trump was running, a big part of what Republicans have been talking about prior to that, and President Trump himself, was that Republicans were going to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. That's been a core pledge of the party. How important is it to the GOP to pass something and to pass something, hopefully, that the American public likes?
It's incredibly important. I don't know that it can be overstated, because they ran on this for 7 years and they won elections on this for 7 years. You know, ever since the Affordable Care Act was passed in 2010, they have promised to dismantle this. Mitch McConnell has said in the past he wants to get rid of it root and branch. So if they can't deliver on this, which is their big legislative promise, it raises questions about what they're going to be able to do and whether they're going to be able to deliver on the rest of their agenda. And the window is also closing. The August recess starts at July 30th or July 31st, and then they're gone for a month and they come back and they have to deal with a whole set of issues that are on a deadline, like the budget and a continuing resolution. So if they don't do it by then, it does raise a lot of questions about what they're actually going to accomplish in terms of their big legislative priorities.
How high is the hurdle to see some sort of middle ground for moderates and conservative Republicans on the health care bill?
You know, it really depends on which senator you talk to and on what day. Some are optimistic and think they're getting closer. Others say that they're still a ways off. But the thing is, even if the Senate manages to squeak something through, the process isn't over. Then the Senate and the House are going to have to reconcile the differences between their bill and get it approved by both chambers. And so the Senate is a little bit more moderate than the House in general, but the House has some really conservative members who don't seem to like the direction the bill is taking.
And do you think that this bill, given those differences you just outlined and the hurdle once the bill makes it to the House for that process, do you think this bill will be finished by the July 4th deadline?
It won't be at the House by the July 4th deadline. It's hard to tell. Sometimes Congress can pull it together really quickly, and sometimes they just need to apply a lot of pressure to their members, and things come together pretty miraculously, the way they did with the House bill last month. But the reality is there are 12 working days left until they break for the July 4th recess. And in that time, they need to complete a draft. They need to work out these major issues. They have to get it to the Congressional Budget Office to score it. And then it needs to be public at least for a little while before they vote. And we don't know if they're going to have open debate when it goes to a vote, but if they do, that could take a few days. So it could definitely still happen. It's just a little bit unclear what the path to that vote could be right now.
And Yasmin, what benchmarks are you looking for as far as which way the wind is blowing on this bill as it goes forward in the Senate?
Well, you know, reporters stake out their meetings a couple of times a week where they talk about health care. And so any indication of, you know, how long they might take to phase out Medicaid would give us an idea of whether moderates are sort of winning the battle or if conservatives are winning. If they decide to keep some of these taxes or not, and how many of the taxes they might keep, how they're going to provide tax credits to low-income people, whether they're more generous than the House version or if they're about the same. So those will all give us an indication of which direction the bill is moving in. We just don't have a lot of detail on that yet.
Yasmin, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much.
That was Yasmin Abutaleb, healthcare correspondent for Reuters, and she joined us with an update on the Republican healthcare bill currently in the Senate. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here is executive producer Erica Janik.
Nature and writing have a long history. Rebecca Morrison is following in that tradition, building worlds with her words and trails with her physical labor.
I'm a trail worker. When I tell people that, they don't always know what to imagine. I'm sure they believe, as I used to, that trails were formed by mere foot traffic. After all, not everyone on the trail runs into a crew rolling rocks, creating a reroute, or hauling tree trimmings off into the woods. In reality, there are thousands of us dedicated outdoorsmen who wake up early to repair, create, or maintain the trails we all enjoy. Trail work is tough. Let me repeat that. Trail work is tough. It's rugged, and it's different wherever you do it. I've spent 4 seasons and 17 months doing trail work with the Maine Conservation Corps and California Conservation Corps, and 9 of those I spent as a team leader. I've felled trees with a crosscut saw, slept wrapped in a tarp out under the stars, and lived in the backcountry without technology for 3.5 months. There are other trail crews nationwide, and some help eradicate invasive plants, some live deep in the woods, and some drive to a trailhead every day. They work through rain and snow and freezing temperatures because they're committed, and for the most part, they like the work. In 2014, I graduated from the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire with a focus on creative writing. Since then, I've been working out how to explain my experience in the woods through my words. In my first 8 months doing trails, I wrote every day because I wanted to share my experience with people beyond my trail crews. It seemed only natural. There has long been a link between nature and writing. For proof, we need only read the works of authors like John Muir, Henry David Thoreau, Edward Abbey, Rick Bass, and Terry Tempest Williams, all of whom have long explored how woods and words go together. Sometimes a person's words can affect the preservation of nature, and other times nature can move someone to words. In a way, my trail work helps hikers create an experience similar to mine, and the pieces of experience they lack, I'm attempting to construct through my writing. They've done it, and so can I, but in describing anything foreign to someone, I know it will take a lot of effort. Writing is tough, sometimes as tough as trail work. But as I struggle to work on trails, I also struggle to write about it. I try to keep in mind that neither is rewarding without a struggle, and the finished product is always better when I take my time with it. I've realized that if I simply explain how to hammer rocks to bits, or what it's like to eat trail mix every day for a week, people won't understand the collective experience as I do. Describing the one mosquito bite on my ankle doesn't do justice to the 12 others I scratch at relentlessly. While some of my experiences are indescribable, my goal is to fully explain the ones I can. Though as difficult as both trail work and writing can be, I found I've fallen in love with both. And with a little more work and a little more time, I hope to one day have the words to give people a clear picture of what it's like out here on the trail.
Rebecca Morrison is a writer and trail builder based in California. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Now, archery and bow hunting have long histories in Wisconsin, and changing technology has made bows more powerful and accurate. But for some archers, the old ways are still the best, and that includes making their own bows from single pieces of wood.
Wisconsin Traditional Archers is a group committed to preserving the hunting practices of the past and the craft of bow making. They recently hosted a bow jam event in New Berlin where 40 men, women, and children gathered to make their own bows and to share their expertise.
Gary Vanden Langenberg joins us now to tell us more about the magic of self-made bows. He's the president of Wisconsin Traditional Archers. Gary, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yes, thank you very much for having me.
How did you first get into wooden bows and making your own?
Actually, I'm only 40 years old, so I grew up in the age of compound bows. As a kid growing up, that's what everybody did. So that's what I started with, was a compound bow. And as I got further into archery, I just started to get a little disheartened with the mass media out there. It seemed like all the mainstream hunting media was just trying to push products. There was no respect for the animals. And actually, I got into it by reading a copy of Traditional Bowhunter magazine. And I really read that, and I thought, wow, these guys really have it right, you know. So I explored it further, and then I got myself a used recurve and some bows, and actually I've never looked back. I sold my compound bow, and then I started making bows 2 years later.
Now, for people not familiar with bows and archery, can you explain the difference between the wooden bows you're working with and now making and the kind of compound bows you can buy, you know, at a store?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, so traditional bows are generally recurves, long bows, or self bows, which is basically one piece of wood or one stick and a string. Real simple, no fixed sights, no rests, no cables or pulleys like you'd see on a compound bow. You hold it back with just your muscles. There's no mechanical let off to help the archer in that way. And then you shoot it instinctively or with what some people call gap shooting. And basically, it's really a fulfilling way to shoot to hunt with traditional archery.
Now, with the same size bow, do I have to be stronger to pull one of these self bows than one of these compounds with those pulleys?
You have to be the same strength to pull it initially, but then there's let off on a compound bow. So a 70-pound compound will have, say, 85% let off. So once you get at full draw, you'll only be holding, say, 20 pounds, whereas a self bow or another traditional bow, you're holding that full weight the entire time.
Now, talk us through the first time you worked on making your own bow.
Yeah, the first time I made my own bow was actually a laminated bow, which is a bow involving many strips of wood, and it's epoxied together, and it was actually a very stressful event. I did it in my basement, and I constructed all the different things I needed to make this bow, and in the midst of gluing it all up and laminating this bow, I had epoxy everywhere, and it was quite a mess. It was obviously not the best bow I've ever made, but I still have it. It's in my den, and I still like that bow, and I shoot it once in a while. But yeah, I've made quite a few since, and it's really fulfilling to make your own archery equipment and then practice with it and hunt with it. So,
what was it like the first time you actually took it out and pulled it back and fired an arrow?
Oh, it was awesome. Yeah, Perry Anderson, one of our great bowyers in our club, Wisconsin Traditional Archers, he said it best. He said, it's really a magical feeling when you take a stave and you can work it down and form it, and then you can take that and put a string on it. And when you fire that first arrow, you know, then your stave has become a bow and you've become a bowyer, and there's nothing else like it.
And were you, on this first one you made, did you just learn it from the magazines and the internet, or had you worked with someone on how to do this?
No, I did it all from online. I actually went to Bingham Projects, binghamprojects.com, and they have tutorials on how to do it. And then I read some books and kind of fumbled my way through it from there. But since then, I've made some very nice bows, and I hunt with them to this day.
So. And now you're with this group of traditional archers, Wisconsin Traditional Archers, and you hosted this bow jam where you got different people together. I imagine you shared tips. Does it help making bows to actually work with other people and see the kind of tricks that they have developed on their own?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, WTA, Wisconsin Traditional Archers, we started the bow jam a few years ago. And what it is a workshop organized to teach people how to turn a stave. Now, this is for self bows. So a self bow is basically a one-piece wooden bow made out of a stave, which is a quarter section of a log. And you form it and you work it into a working bow. And usually you can get a bow done in a weekend. There's some very good instruction out there from some expert bowyers, but it's totally open for anybody from beginners to experienced bowyers, all ages, men, women, kids. It's really a lot of fun. And self-bows truly are a work of art. You're not just carving the wood into a bow and plowing your way through it and making it a certain shape. You got to follow the growth rings, the grain of the wood, the location of the knots, and other imperfection in the wood must be noted. And you're almost discovering the shape of the bow as you go.
Wow. So any bow somebody makes out of one piece of wood is going to be unique. You can't duplicate that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, they're all one of a kind, unique for sure.
That's what you hear sculptors say. They're not making a shape. They're finding the shape in the stone. That's how you feel when you start working with this piece of wood?
Absolutely, yeah, yes, and it's really fun watching the young kids and even the older beginners get started, and they just are amazed once they start shooting arrows out of this bow that they constructed in one weekend. So,
And then what is the difference between hunting with these self bows you made yourself versus, again, those compound bows you might have bought?
Yeah, hunting traditional, I mean, traditional archers are a different breed. I guess by using a traditional bow, we're voluntarily giving some advantage back to our quarry because we have to be a lot closer than somebody with a rifle or a muzzleloader or a compound bow. So we're basically giving some advantage back to the quarry by imposing self-limitations on our choice of equipment. That doesn't mean you can't be successful. I've had tons of success hunting with traditional bows, and it's so gratifying when you do take an animal that way. It's just really a great way to hunt, and it is very fulfilling.
If somebody's out there listening who is a bow hunter or someone who's into archery because of, I don't know, Robin Hood or Hunger Games or you name it, and they think, yeah, wow, that'd be cool, how would you recommend they get started on trying to make their own bow?
The best way I would recommend is get started in traditional archery first, learn how to shoot a traditional bow, and then get into making bows. That's how I did it, and that seems to be the best way. Basically, there's a couple of traditional archery shops that are just outside Wisconsin. One is the Footed Shaft out of Rochester, Minnesota, and the other one is Three Rivers Archery in Indiana. Both of those shops are dedicated to traditional archery. They don't service compound bows or any of that other stuff. They are experts at traditional archery, and they can help get you set up and get you arrows that match the bow. That's so key. One of the biggest mistakes new traditional archers make is they'll go grab dad or grandpa's recurve out of the attic and a handful of arrows and go try shooting it, and they're kind of doomed to failure from the start because the arrows don't match the bow and it doesn't work right. So contacting a professional like that is really a good way to do it. And also at our larger events like our bow jam, our state shoot, and at our banquet every year in February, the Footed Shaft actually takes his trailer and he comes right out to the shoot or to the site, and he's a vendor there, and he has his whole shop right there. So any of our events, the larger ones, will have plenty of vendors that can help you out.
Gary, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, I appreciate it. Thanks very much for having me.
That's Gary Vanden Langenberg, president of Wisconsin Traditional Archers, talking about making your own bow.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
Now, when Janet Napolitano got the nomination for Secretary of Homeland Security in 2008, a former Pennsylvania governor said that Napolitano was perfect for the job because she has no family and could then devote 19 or 20 hours a day to the job.
Our next guest argues that single employees shouldn't have to pick up the slack for their married coworkers. She just wrote a piece about that on the publication Quartz, and you can find that piece on the Central Time Facebook page. Bella DiPaolo is the author of Singled Out, How Singles Are Stereotyped, Stigmatized, and Ignored, and Still Live Happily Ever After. Bella, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Bella, why do you say that single people are expected to pick up the extra slack at work?
Because they are. Often it's the married workers who are more valuable and whose needs and wishes are considered more important. So if they want to take time off or leave early or not have to come in for the holidays or not have to take the travel for the weekends, they are more likely to get the nod than single people are in many workplaces, even though workplaces should be about work.
And can you give us some examples of how that plays out in the workplace where there's a gap between the way that married people with kids are treated compared to single people?
Yeah, I think it's especially true when the married people have kids. So if they want to leave early to go to their kids' soccer games or take the kid to the dentist or whatever the reason might be, and employers often look fondly or at least tolerantly upon those requests, or the parents will just ask the people without kids to cover for them, and that's expected to be in many places a reasonable request. And what that ignores is that single people should not have to do more work for the same pay. And it ignores the fact that single people have their own lives and their own people in their lives who are important to them and their own commitments and obligations and interests and passions. It's as if the assumption is that if you're single and you don't have kids, that means you don't have a life. And therefore, you can cover for your colleagues who are assumed that they do have a life, you know. And it's a way of treating some workers more positively, more generously than others, in ways that have nothing to do with what work should be about, which is about the quality of your work.
So you don't think that if a single person were to go to their boss and say, I have to take my aunt to a doctor's appointment, you think that person is going to be less likely to get a thumbs up?
On the average, yes. Now, I'm not saying this is true in all workplaces. There are bosses and workplaces that are becoming more attuned to these issues, which, of course, they should be, because the number of people who are single has been growing for decades. Every time the Census Bureau releases a new report, it shows that there are more single people. And even if you count people who get married, Americans spend more years of their adult lives not married than married. So this is an issue that should be becoming increasingly salient and important, and something that's attended to in the workplaces. And some workplaces really are good. Some employers are terrific about these matters. But still, on the average, it's the single people without kids who are getting the shorter end of the stick.
We had a comment from Allie on Facebook who posted and said that what you're describing happens to single people as well as to married people without children. What is your response to that?
Yes, that's part of it. Part of it is the issue of children. But it's not just children. It's also the issue of married people versus single people, even apart from children. And some of those disadvantages to single people are written right into our federal laws. So, for example, the Marriage and Family Leave Act lets any workers from an eligible workplace take time off to care for parents or children. It doesn't matter what your marital status is. But if you're married, you can also take time off under that act to care for your spouse. But I, as a single person, I can't take time off to care for someone important to me, like a close friend or a sibling, and no such person can take time off under the act to care for me. So there are aspects of really important kinds of discrimination written right into our laws.
And in that same vein, you talk about how there is more financial fragility for people who are single. And they make, for instance, single women make far less in their lifetime than married women.
Yes, that's right. I think people often think, well, oh, if we have to lay someone off or we have to cut back on their hours, let it be the single people because they don't have anyone to support. Well, single people, especially if they're living alone, have only their own income to depend on. So if they get laid off or their hours are cut back, they don't have a spouse who can then pick up the slack, and they don't have a spouse that they can then say, well, I'll go on my spouse's health care plan. They're really more financially fragile in the fact that it's just them. There's not a fallback on opportunity.
We're talking to Bella DiPaolo right now, author of a piece in Quartz called Single Workers Aren't There to Pick Up the Slack for Their Married Bosses and Colleagues. And Bella, do you think part of this is that there's this assumption that, you know, kind of that single people are lonely, and that if they're not at work, they're probably sitting at home watching TV? And in fact, you know, you say single people are way more involved in their communities than married people are.
Right. So that's another example of how our stereotypes about single people have real-world implications. So people do believe that. It's almost like they think, oh, if we have single people cover the holidays, we're doing them a favor, because otherwise they'd be home crying in their beer. And it kind of ignores the fact that single people are in many ways more connected to more different people in their lives. For example, they do more than married people to maintain their ties with their friends and their siblings and their parents and their neighbors. In contrast, in these studies, to follow people over the course of their lives and see how they change when they get married compared to when they were single, couples who move in together or get married become more insular. So they pay less attention to their friends and their parents. So it's just the opposite of the stereotype that single people are isolated and lonely, when actually they are the ones nurturing their connections. And also, as you mentioned, doing more for their communities. They volunteer more in every kind of organization that the Bureau of Labor Statistics keeps track of, except one, which is religious organizations. Married people volunteer more for them. But single people are, in many ways, the life of their towns and communities. They're the ones, you know, going out to dinner and taking classes and getting involved in public events.
So do you think there could actually be negative ramifications on society and communities in general and as a whole, because single people maybe aren't given quite as much of a long leash when it comes to how they're treated at work and given the opportunity to engage as much as they might otherwise?
Oh, sure. I mean, single people have a lot to offer, and that's something else that's rarely recognized in the workplace. So if, for example, you're a boss who wants someone who's good at organizing and figuring out how to get things done, well, single people have to figure out how to get everything done in their lives. It's not like when people get married and they split up the tasks and, you know, one spouse does one set of things and the other spouse does the other, and the one that doesn't do certain things often kind of loses their knack at doing them. And single people either have to do everything themselves or figure out how to recruit other people, find them, hire them, find people to help. And so I think that's a very valuable skill in the workplace. Single people also value work that's meaningful more than married people do. They have a certain confidence in their own opinions. They're actually more committed, not just to their jobs, but to their organizations and professions than married people are. So there are a lot of ways that single people bring great value to the workplace in ways that just are not recognized at all.
Just briefly, why do you say that single people value meaningful work more than married people?
Oh, because there's a study that went on for 9 years, and it started when people were at the end of their high school careers, and they asked them things like, you know, what would you value in a job? And there were things like, you know, the meaningfulness, the intrinsic interest, or more extrinsic things like how much you get paid, what's your opportunities for advancement. And 9 years later, the people who were single said that they cared more about the intrinsic meaningfulness of the job. And the people who were married said they cared more about extrinsic things. But even more interestingly, when they were in high school, before anyone was married, they were already showing those preferences. So the people who would stay single for at least the next 9 years were already saying they valued meaningful work more than people who would eventually get married said that they did.
We're talking with Bella DiPaolo now, author of a piece in Quartz called Single Workers Aren't There to Pick Up the Slack for Their Married Bosses and Colleagues.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this idea? How are single employees treated at your workplace? Do you see stereotypes of single people at work in general? If you're single, how do these stereotypes affect you? If you're married, if you have kids, do you feel like your workplace is bending over backwards to meet your needs? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up our conversation and get to your calls in just a little bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrer.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're continuing our discussion now with Bella DiPaolo. She's the author of Singled Out, and she wrote a piece for Quartz called Single Workers Aren't There to Pick Up the Slack for Their Married Bosses and Colleagues.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a single person, do you feel discriminated against because of that at work? Are you expected to do more? Do you think there are negative stereotypes about single people? And if you're married with kids, do you see this imbalance, or do you feel like your workplace doesn't take your needs as a parent seriously? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll take a caller now. We have Chuck joining us in Beaver Dam. Chuck, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
My question for your guest is, what sort of data are you using to come to these conclusions and make these assertions? Because, I mean, I'm not saying you're wrong, but I can also see a lot of reasons that have nothing to do with being single why people would be asked to work on weekends, for example. It could be that they're just younger. You know, they're fresh out of college. They aren't married. They're younger. They don't have as much experience or seniority. So the senior people get the first crack at being off work, and the same, you know, type of thing for that. I'm worried you're confusing correlation with causation.
Chuck, thank you for the point. And how do you respond to that, Bella?
I can assure you I'm not confusing correlation with causation. I've taught research methods for more than 2 decades at the graduate student level, so I'm well aware of those issues. Thank you very much. But yes, that is an important point. And there is systematic research on the ways that single people are treated in the workplace relative to people who are married. Wendy Casper is an example of a researcher who has done that work. So the best research will compare single to married workers or workers with and without children and control for the different kinds of factors you mentioned so that it's not just a matter of being younger or older. If it were just based on anecdotes, then yes, those would be possibilities. But there is a research literature as well.
And Bella, what can an employer do if they want to level the playing field and make sure that all their employees are treated with the same yardstick?
One of the things they can do is have a menu option where everyone is afforded, with regard to benefits, for example, the same dollar amount in benefits, but each employee, each worker gets to choose the benefits that they find relevant to them. So any way you can find to make sure that every worker has the same opportunities and the same potential for rewards and perks and privileges. So, and even things that can't always be the same at one point in time, like who has to cover the holidays, that can be arranged so that over time everybody has to cover equally.
All right. Well, thank you for answering that one. Let's go to another caller now. We've got Maggie on the line in Madison. Maggie, hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. So I was just wondering if your speaker could comment on the fact that single people do get promoted at higher rates and they do achieve higher professional achievement throughout their career, and they are rewarded for the fact that they can, quote-unquote, pick up the slack. And this is unfair to both single and married and people with children, the fact that employers sometimes do assume that single people could pick up the slack, but then they are rewarded with higher incomes and higher promotion rates and higher professional achievements in the end, because we do know that women with children do lose quite a bit of pay throughout their lifetime for being mothers. Thank you.
Maggie, thank you for that call. And Bella, what about that? She says that singles get promoted at higher rates.
This is where we have a big sex differences. Yes, there are ways in which women, especially mothers, are really devalued in the workplace, but it's not true for men. So there are now some great studies comparing single men and married men in the workplace, And married men are paid more than single men, even when single men have the same seniority, the same contributions, and even in one study where the married and single men were twins, identical twins, the married men were paid an average of 26% more than the single men. So for men, there really is a disadvantage that goes to the single men. And I think it goes back to the point that was raised earlier about stereotypes. People think, oh, you know, the married men are more stable, they're committed, more committed to their jobs, and they're going to be better workers. But you can't base, or you should not base, pay raises and promotions on what you think a person is like based on stereotypes. It should be based on their work performance.
We're talking with Bello De Paula right now, author of Singled Out, How Singles Are Stereotyped, Stigmatized, and Ignored, and Still Live Happily Ever After. She says that at the workplace, a lot of the time, single people get the short end of the stick. They have to work the weekends and the holidays, and that there are other imbalances there between the way single people and married people or married people with children are treated. And we want to know if this is your experience. Call us and let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Bella, what has been your personal experience with this? Have you seen this firsthand?
Yeah, I have. I've had that assumption that, you know, it's because I'm single, I could not possibly have anyone else to support or to spend my money on. And the example I gave in the Quartz article is that when I talked to a boss about pay once, he said, you know, I know this can't really be about the money because, you know, you're single, you don't have any kids. Well, my mother had been widowed a few years before then, and how did he know that, or why did he assume, well, he probably didn't even think of the possibility that I could have been helping her, and if I were, I would have never said it. And there are other ways, too, that single people are helping other people in ways we don't even notice, like building up college funds for their nieces or nephews, or taking in other people in their family or others who need a place when things are tough. I mean, there are just so many ways that single people are helping other people that don't get recognized.
Let's take another caller now. We have Julie joining us in Green Bay. Julie, hello.
Hi there. I just had a comment. You were talking about that the single people were usually the ones that had to work weekends and nights and kind of the not fun hours. And I guess, you know, in my 30 years of working, that has not been my experience. I work a job where people do work weekends and holidays and nights. And we've always divvied it up. You knew ahead of time if you were, you know, required to work that. And if it was a holiday, you had your rotating holidays.
Gotcha.
That really has not been my experience.
All right, Julie, thank you for sharing that. And Bella, we're getting pretty short on time, but do you think there is perhaps a sea change happening in that maybe some of the things that we're discussing today are starting to shift in our workplaces and our culture?
I sure hope so. I mean, it's wonderful to hear experiences like those that your caller just described, and I hope that that workplace is a model for others so that other workplaces, too, join the 21st century and treat their single workers just as well as they treat their married ones.
And we'll leave it there. Bella, thank you so much for joining us today.
Okay, thank you.
That was Bella De Paula. She's the author of Singled Out, How Singles Are Stereotyped, Stigmatized, and Ignored, and Still Live Happily Ever After. And you can keep this conversation going. Share your stories in agreement or not, and find a link to her piece on the Central Time Facebook page.